All right, thank you to everybody who's here. Again, hope you're having a nice libation of your choice and some tasty food edibles back there. This is a live podcast. It's a newer format for us, so we hope you'll enjoy this. And one of the things that we love doing at Fetch is bringing collaborative lectures to you. So where we have a generalist, who I'm representing, and then two of the most awesome veterinary dermatologists that you can find globally with me. So I'm very honored to be part of this trio today. And we're going to do our best in the next hour to demystify food allergies and diet trials. So before we go any further, again, I'm Natalie Marks. I'm a veterinarian generalist out of Chicago. I'm also a clinical consultant for DVM360. I do a lot of teaching and consulting around the industry, and also angel investing, if anybody wants to talk about that too. I wear a lot of hats. I'm a mom of three, and I'm a ruthless softball coach. My daughter's playing right now, so I'm going to be getting some feeds of what her score is, just FYI. I'm turned over to my colleagues.
Hi, thank you all for being with us tonight. I'm Dr. Joya Griffin. I'm a veterinary dermatologist in Louisville, Kentucky, or Louisville, as we say it, up the road. And I've been a dermatologist for 15 years. Love what I do on my other job. I have three children, a set of twins who are 7 and a 10-year-old boy. He's in charge right now. They're in the hotel. So if it catches on fire across the street, that's what happened. But I think they're good, hopefully.
So. And I'm Julia Miller, also a dermatologist. I also work in Louisville, Kentucky with this lady. So if you ever want to come hang out with us for a little bit, we love having vets chill and shadow. We love teaching about derm. I don't have human children because, you know, I'm smart and I like my money and my time. No, I'm just kidding. But I do have cute little bully dogs. So that's kind of my thing. And horses, you know, so I don't like my money, as it turns out. Yeah.
All right. Awesome. So what we wanted to start with is to just be real and to see how many of you actually like doing diet trials in practice. That's what we thought. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Correct.
No. it's very challenging, right? I mean, having obviously recommended, I'm sure many of us having done it personally, maybe we have uncooperative spouses or partners or children or all of the above, or our own admitted self that's not helping to keep compliant. It's really important, I think, for us, especially in general practice, to be choosing wisely. We don't recommend food trials for everything, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're not going to get the compliance and maybe it's not necessary. So I think to set the stage, I wanted to ask Joy and Julia, how often do we actually see true diagnosed food allergies in our canine patients?
Yeah, the numbers are kind of all over the board, I think, but up to about 20%. So it's still a fairly small percentage, I think, you know, especially when we're talking about non-seasonal pruritus, patients that have recurrent otitis, sometimes perianal pruritus, those types of symptoms. And even if they have concurrent GI symptoms like vomiting, loose stool, diarrhea, those things all put together, it's still 20% or less.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not that common. I mean, they are out there, right? And I think the true food allergy alone that truly only has a food allergy is a pretty rare bird, truthfully. We do see, I think, more and more combinations of atopic dogs that also have a food component. Those are the hardest, right? They're the hardest to manage because they can be the hardest to diagnose. And that percentage gets up a little higher, you know, in that 20-ish range. But certainly just a true pure food allergy is not a common thing. So a diet trial should not be something you recommend for every patient every time. It is important that you still have good selection of what patient you think might actually have a food allergy.
So I don't know if both of you get these, but I would guess most of us in the generalist space get it. You probably do too. One of my challenging clients, and I'll say that with a smile, would be the profile of the well-intentioned Google researcher who comes in with a long list or a stack of papers of all of the allergens, probably a test that's been done over the counter, right? And they've decided that their dog is allergic to every protein known to man except New Zealand emu that's been imported. Yeah. And every grain that's known to man, so they're not including it, so now they're just giving emu, and then they're cooking themselves, and they refuse to listen to you about what the common allergens are. So I'd love to know what the common allergens actually are for canines and how you, as dermatologists, manage those clients. Am I the only one that gets those?
Oh, yeah.
No, I didn't think so. So
it's hard. We get those too. Right? Trust me. Because you give them to us. Thank you. Thank you so much. Because what do you do? You say, you know, I think you should go to a dermatologist. Right. Thank you. I appreciate you and your business. No, keep sending it. Keep sending it. So as far as common allergens, right? Chicken has been around for a long time and is still a very common, one of the most common. Beef is starting to slowly eclipse chicken though. So be aware, beef is really coming up in popularity as far as allergies are concerned. And those are really our top one and two out there in the literature, are chicken and beef. Certainly we can see things like lamb and pork and potentially wheat and soy, but those are much, much, much less common as far as allergens are concerned. And as far as testing goes, right, there's a lot of interesting food allergy testing out there. The hair and saliva tests are a great way to waste your cash. I love that because I do love to bring up the study that I wish that I had been able to do this study because it actually sounds like research. It would have been fun. But they submitted teddy bear hair and tap water. And guess what? It was allergic. Can you believe that? So what a viable, accurate test that found out that the teddy bear was allergic to alfalfa. Very important. So the saliva and hair tests are not useful whatsoever for environmental or food. But then when we talk about blood allergy testing, serum allergy testing for environmental is a different story. You know, there's accuracy in that. But serum allergy testing for food, unfortunately, has just been proven not to be accurate. It's not repeatable. It's not repeatable between the same patient or between different labs. So serum allergy testing at this particular point in time, I reserve the right to change my mind, is not recommended. And the thing I always say to my clients is, I wish this was accurate. I would love to have an easy button. I would love to draw your dog's blood and say, he's beef allergic. Let's take him off of beef. Peace be with you. But I don't do it because it isn't accurate and we have to move forward with our diet trials instead.
Super, super frustrating. I think that we see that more and more patients coming in with serum testing done and then they're stuck on a certain protein that they think their dog can't have. And then a lot of times I'll ask them, well, since you avoided that protein, has your dog improved? And a lot of times, obviously they haven't because they've come to the dermatologist because they're actually truly atopic dogs, but it can be very frustrating once they've done the serum allergy testing because then they're stuck on that. And if they really do need to do an elimination diet trial, it's almost impossible to get them to do one because they feel like they've already done that.
Yes. And they're gonna die with those food allergy testing results in their hands. Like I'm telling you, we can say, we spent years and money and blood, sweat, and tears being educated about this. And they're like, yeah, but it says he's allergic to peas. And I literally would be like, I don't believe it. Rip it up. And they're like, yeah, but remember the peas? And I'm like, stop it. So when you do the serum allergy testing, not only is it inaccurate, but you're ruining my life. So please don't do that. Don't open the door. Don't waste your clients' money. Don't give them false hope. Don't do that. I don't recommend those testings. Yeah.
So you don't believe in these?
No.
Okay. The passion. Sure. All right. Now you're talking about this mostly for dogs, but is it different for dogs and cats in regards to common food allergens?
There's some slight variability. Beef is still high on the list. I believe dairy's on the list and fish. I think those are the top three most common allergens in cats. But for us, we don't really get too stuck on that. Like what we usually do is, I always tell people I really don't like doing diet trials. I think they take a lot of work. It takes a lot to get a client to adopt to doing this diet trial for the prescribed time. And so if I'm going to do a diet trial, I want to do it once and do it well. So really, we're usually looking at the list of ingredients that patient has been eating, because if they're food allergic, it's going to be to what they're currently eating on a regular basis, not, the pizza that it got, once 3 months ago. It's going to be what they're eating on a regular basis that's causing these pruritic symptoms. So I take inventory of that, including medications, supplements. We really try to get away from saying, well, what is your dog eating? Because sometimes they'll just tell you the dog food that they give, but they forget about all of the treats and table food. I asked a client the other day, I said, well, do you feed your pet table food? No, he never eats at the table. People food, human food, like the things that we cook to feed ourselves. And, and she still kind of, blinked her eyes at me. But you have to be very specific in the questions that you ask. What does your dog get by mouth? And then we create this kind of scaffold of, okay, of all the ingredients that the dog is eating, all the proteins, and then we try to find something completely new and different. So that's how we choose, and that can be challenging.
Yeah.
We'll definitely get into that. I, I want to shift just a little bit, though, because part of our podcast today is about demystifying and debunking myths. So I want to start with one of the myths that I think I get pretty frequently in general practice, which is, I'm going to go grain-free.
Yeah, right?
Every human out there is going grain-free, and it's so much better for us. But, I mean, who isn't? But tell me about that. Is there any truth to that, and why not?
I love grains.
Grains are great.
Grains are good. Grains are great. They're great for the heart. They're great for the fart. You know what I mean? Like, grains are great. No, it is. There is the occasional wheat allergic dog or soy allergic dog, but they are really, truly the low end of the list. And so very grain-free diets are not recommended, I think, by almost any dermatologist as a go-to to start with. So it's exceedingly rare that there's a grain allergy that causes skin signs and dermatology issues in humans or animals. Okay.
Love it. What about the notion that my dog didn't have a food allergy when it was younger, so it can't get one when it's older.
Yeah, that's a forever one. Yeah. He's always been fed chicken. How can he be allergic to this? You know, so we hear that every day, I think. And that one's just one you just have to say, no, that's actually not true. I mean, there's really, people and dogs can develop a food hypersensitivity anytime to anything. So it doesn't matter that they've eaten it their whole lives. And that's a frustrating one to kind of demyth.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody wants the food allergy to be triggered by a diet change, but it's actually a diet they've been consistently exposed to. So the hallmark of a food allergic dog is one that hasn't had a lot of diet changes, or at least a lot of protein changes. Remember, you can change the diet a lot, but if chicken is in all of those diets, that dog is still consistently eating chicken. The other thing to remember with all the over-the-counter foods, most of them are cross-contaminated to some degree and may have a little bit of chicken in them. So even if they're feeding a beef-based diet, well, first of all, was chicken the eighth ingredient in that? Probably. Chicken meal is in everything. But also, was that food cross-contaminated with chicken? So, you know, certainly it usually is a food that they have consistently eaten, a protein that they have consistently eaten. That's what they're allergic to. There's rarely a diet change trigger, almost never.
I think another myth that a lot of our clients have is that if my dog was food allergic, they would always have diarrhea. Like they can't get over the fact that there might be other clinical signs associated with that. Do you hear that as well?
Oh yeah, but his poops are normal.
Poops are normal.
And I say, I'm happy for you, is usually what I say.
We get a lot of pictures of beautiful poops. Yes. And horrible poops, but a lot of beautiful poops too.
I avoid those like the plague. If they're like, can I show? No. Don't bring it to me. Don't show it to me.
I would think you would be fine with that.
Yeah, I know it's weird, right? I have a line. I have a line and there it is.
Nice
poops. That's funny. I think Craig likes to see the poops.
Yeah, that's so funny. Yeah.
We do ask about, how frequently they're pooping though. You know, if they know, because there's evidence that, if they're pooping 3 to 4 more times a day, that could be a sign of a food allergy. And so that's something that we kind of ask about, sometimes ask about flatulence, those kinds of things. But the overt vomiting and diarrhea is not always there. And that can be hard for people to understand.
I think the last one that I get a lot too is, well, I took the chicken out. Mm-hmm. So my dog must not be food allergic, right? So is there sort of this overwhelming sort of consensus that it's chicken or nothing with a lot of clients? Like they see online, it must be the chicken, and they don't understand that there's other proteins that can happen too.
100%.
So we're not alone in this.
Oh no, we get that too. We get that too. I took all the chicken out, it didn't get better. But then I hearken back to that same cross-contamination thing. You think you took the chicken out, but chicken weaves its little tiny feathers into everything. And the other thing I'll say, so I had a very chicken allergic dog. She was my sentinel for everything. If a company told me that this product didn't contain chicken, I gave it to her and I saw what happened. Peace. I love her. She was wonderful. So what I noticed is that when I would go out food shopping, I would look up a peanut butter bone. I'm going to get this peanut butter bone. I'd read it and the fifth ingredient would be chicken meal. And I'm like, no, it's a chicken and peanut butter bone, you jerks. So I think sometimes people also think they're taking the chicken out, but if they were to even read the labels, it's not as much as they think. And then that cross-contamination, those mislabeled or unlabeled ingredients, means that we probably can never really get the chicken out unless we go the route of a prescription diet or home cooked.
Yeah, and actually Donna Raditick, who's a really awesome boarded veterinary nutritionist, did a really interesting study in 2011 looking at the over-the-counter diets first, because so many of our clients, of course, are like, you want me to do this therapeutic diet for what cost? But I'm going to just go over the counter and pick your choice of limited ingredient diet, and found that 10 out of 12 of those, which had none of mammalian, fish, or dairy listed on the label, actually contained them. So there's a lot of hidden ingredients that we don't see, which I'm sure you're in the same boat, right? We don't recommend those over the counters for food trials for sure. So we've hinted at some of these signs, right? So can have normal poops, but certainly can have GI signs. But what do you see as sort of that? Let's start with the classic high suspicion food allergy patient. What clinical signs do you see?
Well, I mean, they can present just like any other atopic. And I think that is the hardest part of it, because they can present with recurrent otitis only, or in addition to other types of pruritus. They can have facial pruritus. I think that's kind of high on the list, but not always. They can have pedal pruritus, ventrally distributed pruritus. So I think it's, we always, I think in school are trained, it's face and rear, ears and rears, was one of an adage that we were given in vet school. And I think that makes you kind of pigeonhole and think, okay, it can only be. Well, if you have those symptoms, I think we should look into diet. But any non-seasonally pruritic dog could really have a food hypersensitivity. And I think it's important to really rule it out. Because I don't love doing diet trials, if I have a patient that's non-seasonally pruritic, I do start to delve in and ask, well, do you have a patient that may be getting worse in the spring and the summer? Mm-hmm. Are we having more infections? Do we need more interventions? You know, in the warmer months of the year when the pollen levels are higher, maybe that will prioritize atopy over food hypersensitivity or vice versa, if that seasonality is there, even in a non-seasonal pruritic dog. But unfortunately, they can present quite similarly to atopic dermatitis, just to confuse us and make it frustrating.
Yeah, I want to go back to the ears and rears, because how many of you learned that's a food allergy dog?
I did.
Would you say there's any pattern, though? Like, is it bilateral because it's food and it's unilateral because it's an atopic dog, or no pattern anymore? So we can debunk that myth, too.
Let's debunk it.
Debunk.
Yes. Yeah, ears and rears, bye. See you later. Yeah. Could be food, could be atopy, and you don't know. Yeah.
Okay. What about the GI signs? Completely variable, or do you see more types of a certain type of diarrhea over another? What about licking, scooting, anal gland, sacculitis? What do you?
Definitely anal sacculitis can be one that you'll see with food hypersensitivity, but you can also see that with atopy as well. So again, there's a lot of crossover, you know, but if I have a dog that does all of those things, anal sacculitis, recurrent needs for going in and having their anal sacs expressed, and then they also have, you know, facial pruritus, recurrent otitis, I'm going to work the case up. You know, I'm going to rule out food hypersensitivity, and then see what's left over. So I don't want anyone to get like pigeonholed into one symptom, meaning it has to be food allergy, because I think that can be a little bit of a misnomer for us.
Clinically, they really look very similar, and it's frustrating. Like, I wish that there was one clinical sign that would point me in one direction. Now, GI does. So most of my atopic dogs don't have diarrhea unless they have it from other reasons, right? So could you have an atopic dog with EPI? Yes, I did. I have. So, you know, there's other reasons that your dog could have diarrhea. Do a fecal, right? Let's not forget the common things. But, you know, as far as like the clinical signs of food allergy, they almost are identical to atopy. It really, really mimics it. So using just your physical exam and looking at the patient is not enough. You have to use your history taking and get those history clues to guide you towards which direction you might want to go down which path.
So, not to call you out, but have there been any cases where you've been burned, where you're like, I never really had food allergies high on my list, but it turned out to be that? Like any subtle findings or cues? Can you tell us one of those?
A lot of it's lack of response to therapy. So you're using typical antipruritic drugs like Apoquel, Zenrelia, Cytopoint, whatever, even steroids, and they just don't respond to anything. And then you go back and take inventory of the history and realize, we've actually never done a diet trial on this dog, you know, or is it a seasonally atopic dog that has gone wild? Like, it's become very severe. It's now refractory. Could that atopic have developed a food reactivity? And of course they can. And so those are the cases where I go back and I'm like, oh, shoot. So I try in my notes, if I have a non-compliant person or maybe I deprioritized food hypersensitivity, I'll put that note, like a novel protein diet trial has not been done. As I try to put that there, so then I can go back and see, well, you know, we've never done it because these people gave treats or they felt the need to, I don't know, you know, they just were not going to be a good diet trial family. So I just put it lower on the list, but we'll go back and do those sometimes after the fact.
I've been burned more by cats. I will say that.
Yeah.
Because cat diet trials are so much tougher for lots of reasons, right? Cats are pickier, although there's still a lot of good diets that cats are interested in, and you can do them. But I've definitely been burned more by cats where I've worked it up then for Adapi, and I've done all the drugs, and we've been through a lot, and the cat is not responding like I thought it would. And then I'm like, I've never done food. And we finally do food and the cat does great. And I sit there going, man, did I just spend 6 months of Atopica and tears and vomiting and diarrhea and I just needed to do food in this stinking cat? So I would say cats have burned me a little bit more for sure.
I mean, they're tough creatures.
They are. I love them, but
they're amazing,
tough.
They're amazing, but tough. Yes. So I want to shift gears a little bit. I think we've got a pretty good understanding of the patient we're sort of thinking about and what that might look like. But let's go into the client conversation. Mm-hmm. So Itchy Dog comes into us. When does the discussion about food trial happen? Is it for you? Is it the first, maybe different for you than generalists, right? But is it the first visit? Are we dictating by history? Is it the repeat offenders? Like thinking about generalist practice, when would that conversation happen?
I think that it's going to be different for you guys than for us, probably, because by the time they come to us, we have a track record. We have a history. Now, if it's June and it's a Labrador and it's the first time they've ever had issues, I don't talk about food. I don't even think about food. Could that dog be a food allergic Labrador that is starting in June just to be a jerk bag? Yeah, it's possible. I mean, it's the lab. He's lovely. We love him. But I don't think about food that first visit. I treat that dog like an atopic because Adapi is more common, and then we see what we get with those results. If I've been seeing that patient for the last 6-8 months and things are not working well, my treatments aren't working well, and now it's cold, it's December, it's Christmas time, and you would expect your environmental allergies to hopefully be a little bit better, then I start to talk about the diet trial. So sometimes it does take a little bit longer to get there because I want to know a seasonality. I don't talk about food if I don't know a seasonality. If that dog is non-seasonal and we know that, like maybe it's the first time you're seeing it, but you're the third opinion, and we know that that dog or cat has had non-seasonal pruritus, then it might be the first time that you see that animal that you talk about food. But if it's a, you know, first or second time offender and we don't know the seasonality yet, then I don't talk about food till I know that. Because really food should be a non-seasonal thing.
Yeah, I think that's critical for generalists because all of us being derm educators and we go around the country talking to colleagues, one of the biggest pushbacks is I don't have time. I don't have time in my practice to have the discussions that dermatologists get to have. And I somewhat get that, right? I mean, but part of it is we don't have to have the food allergy long diatribe discussion at a first-time offender who that's the first time they've ever been itchy, right? We can rule out infections and rule out parasites and control pruritus, obviously, and then see how that patient does. We don't have to go through that long, if you know the five bubble journey, right, of the diagnostic for an itchy dog. And I think that's one way that we could be much more efficient with our patients is not to jump, right? We don't, it's up to 20%. It's not every patient. And if it's, this is a 3-year-old dog and this is the first time they've been itchy, could it be a food trial or food allergy dog? It could. But there's so many other things that are more likely. So from a client communication perspective, I really strongly urge thinking about how can we take the most effective histories and how can we be really effective and efficient with our time with our clients so we don't get burned out too. Those are long discussions, right?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So for those first times, let's think about that. So what is in your instructions conversation to a client that comes to you and you're like, okay, we're here. Yeah. We're at the diet trial. First of all, how do you determine a client that can do it?
A lot of it's an honest conversation. I mean, if they really are completely against it, I am not going to push a diet trial on them because I want to do it well and I want to do it once. And so if we can't get the adopters and we can't get them to do a prescription or a home cooked diet, then for me, maybe we just table it and we write it in the notes. Because if they're not going to do it well, I just don't really see the point. So if they have toddlers and they're telling you that and they're lacking sleep and they... Or they have their grandmother that lives there and they know that she just cannot be. Sometimes the husband is in the room and she's like, I can't do this.
Yeah.
Like, he's not going to listen, you know. So if they're being honest about it, you just table it for now.
Yeah.
Let me just put that note down. But if they're going to do it, we discuss it. We select the diet based off of the best choice, based off of what they've been eating. And then a lot of times I send them home with samples to make sure that the pet's going to eat it. And then we transition onto that diet. We discuss it, how long they're going to do it, the things they're not allowed to have. And then we also write that into the record. And then we also give them a handout. Handouts are great. I think they're our friend. And we can really, use those to help shorten that conversation that you're having in the clinic. And then we also will usually bring them back before the end of that diet trial so that we can make sure that they're doing it right. And I would still say, 30% still don't do it right. Maybe
sure.
more. Maybe more.
We try our best. And we do have the time to really talk through. And they still, I had one that was like, oh, diet trial's going great. I give him his pills and a Slim Jim and he loves it. And I was like, yeah. Sir, that's, you know. But listen, he was happy and I was happy. And that's all that really matters. So I'm hoping that dog is not food allergic because it's never going to have a diet trial and that's okay. I think Dr. Joy brought up a really good point. It's all about honesty and taking away any of the like guilt. So like I've had people that walk in with kids and I'm like, I tell them, I'm like, you can't do a diet trial. And they're like, I know. And so I'm like, that's fine. That's okay. What do we do if that's the case? Well, we treat your dog like an atopic dog. And if it gets better, phenomenal, wonderful news. If your dog really isn't getting better with our Adapi treatments, maybe we do need to send your children to, you know, military school. But no, please don't. But, you know, it's something we can cross that bridge later if it's really not a feasible thing for that client. And I think our clients want to please us because they want us to think, right, that they'll do anything for their dog. And that's great. And I know they will. But the practicality of it is that we have to ask honestly and without guilt. I think that's so important. That's the same way I feel about bathing dogs, man. I'm like, listen, I don't bathe my dog because I'm not going to do it. So I think it is really important that we take this very honestly and openly and talk to the clients instead of just saying, I think your dog has a food allergy. This is the food you're going to use. Thank you. Bye. I'll see you in 6 weeks. That's not going to get it, you know, and then they buy the food and they leave and they're like, what am I doing? You know, so
yeah, I think honest. It's an important point that you're making is that it is a diagnostic test. And so we really explain it like that. And it's not just to sell you the dog food. Like we're really trying to prove something to see if signs are alleviated by this diet. And then we have to re-challenge.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the re-challenge is missed. And a lot of the cases that we get that are referred to us, they've been fed, you know, veterinary prescribed diet for many years, but they're also receiving Apoquel, Cytopoint, all these things, and they're still probably having atopic symptoms, and that's why they're the dermatologist. Yeah. And so that can also be a challenging conversation because the pet parent thinks because they were prescribed X prescription diet that this means my dog is food allergic, and then they just feed the food for
forever,
and they're not seeing any clinical benefit from it. And so we a lot of times have to do that re-challenge in our practice to convince people that maybe you don't need to stay on this. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't have to be this strict with your dog because the diet trial did not fix any of the problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. I love saying that this is a diagnostic test because I think one of the challenges probably across the board, but probably more in general practice is the cost, right? Mm-hmm. The cost of doing a diet trial, you got an English Mastiff and they look at you like, whoa. What did you just say? Right. Yeah. So I think there is, in a client's mind, there is more value in saying, I'm just going to change the food, but this is a diagnostic test. People understand that verbiage.
And I think that when you say it like that, you also let them know that we're eventually going to have you off the hook of this expensive diet. Like we're really just doing this for the prescribed 6 to 8 weeks, or if you're a 12-week diet trialer, totally fine. But we're doing this for a prescribed amount of time, and then we have to re-challenge to prove that your dog needs to stay on this diet. And then a lot of times we do individual ingredient challenges after we've proven that the dog is food allergic, then re-challenge with the old ingredients to try to figure out who the trigger is, because then maybe they have some more liberty with what foods they feed. Maybe you can feed chicken. Maybe you can feed something over the counter that won't cause the dog to flare, and it's cheaper.
Right. So what is your go-to agent for controlling pruritus through a diet trial?
Oh. I'm a big Apoquel user. I love Apoquel. I think it works well in many patients, and I use that a lot. I think steroids are also okay if that's what you need to do. I think Cytopoint is okay, but you only want to use Cytopoint in a diet trial if you know that dog's Cytopoint pattern like clockwork. If you know that Muffy gets their Cytopoint every 30th day, and if it's on the 31st day, she's an itchy mess, I'm okay with you using Cytopoint. But remember, Cytopoint is a little bit of variable activity in dogs. So if you don't know that dog's Cytopoint pattern, if I give them a Cytopoint and they were one of the patients that got the miraculous 6-ish weeks out of it, or maybe even 8 weeks, it can be a little hard to interpret my diet when the diet is doing its work or not doing its work. So Cytopoint I only use if they are known like clockwork Cytopoint kiddos, but it's usually Apoquel is my biggest one, truthfully.
So are you using that through the entire diet trial, or are you starting and stopping along the way to see how that patient responds?
Starting and stopping. Yep. So there's been published evidence that antipruritic drugs like Apoquels and really steroids will shorten the length of the diet trial that you have to do. So if you give that for the first 4 to 6 weeks of your diet trial, stop the antipruritic drug, then you can assess mm-hmm. the itch and then re-challenge with the old diet. So it can shorten the diet trial, which is really nice. Mm-hmm. And also, we always have to put the fire out. We have to treat the symptoms. Yeah. We have to treat the itch. So you really should be doing something in the beginning while you're beginning that diet, because mm-hmm. otherwise people are going to be really unhappy.
Yeah.
And the dog's going to be miserable.
Yeah, the dog's going to be miserable too. Mm-hmm. So what are some subtle failures that you've learned along the way that, oh, I forgot to mention this, but now I do? Meaning, like, don't give raw hides, don't give yeah. supplements, don't give gelatin caps. But what are things that we might have our clients giving that we forget to tell them not to give?
Cheese for pills.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of that. Mm-hmm. Anything for pills, really. They stick pills in anything.
Love it. Yeah.
They forget about their supplements. They forget mm-hmm. about the glucosamine that they're giving. Mm-hmm. Sometimes flavored medications, mm-hmm. Apoquil mm-hmm. flavored now. You know, those kinds of things, I think. Sometimes they don't think table food is mm-hmm. not allowed during mm-hmm. the diet trial. Mm-hmm. So you really have to be very explicit when you're mm-hmm. describing what they need yep. to do, because they don't always get it. Even if you explain it, they still don't get it. And that can be sometimes frustrating.
I've had a few litter fritter failures. You know, if you get the dog that likes to scarf in the litter box, that'll ruin, or cat puke. What a delicacy. Mm-hmm. I literally had a cat on a diet trial eat the other cat's puke. Right? Sad thing is that cat was doing incredibly well, like did so well. And she's like, he only flares when he eats his brother's puke. I'm like, let's talk about that for a minute. And also, it's not normal for cats to puke. Work him up, please. Thank you. But side note, I think like those have been kind of some weirdos. Also, poop out in the yard. You know, mm-hmm. if they're a yard poop snorfer, that's another thing that could potentially cause a flare. That's not what you typically think about.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I live in downtown Chicago. So one of the things that I learned along the way is that it's not only what they get in the house,
yeah.
but like
oh,
I had
yeah.
several dogs that would flare, and the owners were like, I swear I'm not giving anything. Yeah. But the doorman was giving a biscuit every mm-hmm. time they came mm-hmm. in. Right. So I think it's really important to ask, exactly to your point, like everything that goes in the mouth, even mm-hmm. if it's not in your house, mm-hmm. right. It could be a doggy daycare. It Oof. Could be at the groomer. Mm-hmm. It could be at a dog park. It could be at the dog patio, whatever mm-hmm. they're, wherever they're going. So yeah, yeah. totally agree. So we've communicated to this, the client is ready to go. What is your go-to for the diet trial?
Yes.
Yes.
there's a lot. Yeah, yeah, it really does depend. I wish I could tell you that there was one diet I use every time and it's great. I literally within the past month have reached for 7 different diets that I can think of. So it very much depends on my patient and the palatability. It depends on whether they need canned and dry. It depends on, you know, what kind of proteins they've had. If I'm reaching for a novel protein, what have they eaten in the past makes a difference. I do reach for a lot of Blue Buffalo HF for a few reasons. Number one, it is hydrolyzed, and I love that. And it's hydrolyzed into small pieces, which is wonderful. It's hydrolyzed salmon, so it's a little more on the novel list there for a lot of animals. And salmon is not one of the more common allergies we see in dogs. It's incredibly palatable. It doesn't have a nasty salmon burp fish smell. Mm-hmm. And I know because my dog's had it for a while. And it also comes in a canned option. Mm-hmm. The other thing I really like about Blue Buffalo, and I know, yes, it's sponsored, but I genuinely do use it a lot, is it affordability-wise, it is one of the best ones as far as price is concerned. And price matters. It matters to all of us, myself and my clients included. So I reach for HF a lot. For me personally, if I'm reaching for other diets, I do a lot of Royal Canin HP as well. And then I like a lot of the sort of rabbit novel protein diets too, of different companies.
Joya.
Very similar. And a lot of it's really based off of the previous history of that patient and their needs. So if I have mm-hmm. a young dog that needs a lot of treats, I may choose one of our veterinary prescribed diets that has jerky or mm-hmm. has more canned options. There's some boutique company, Rain Clinical Nutrition has a lot of options, but they all have their own kind of niche. Alligator is a great protein source because mm-hmm. it's really uncommon for them to have eaten that as an over-the-counter food. And mm-hmm. I think that really, if you take one key point home, is you have to know the ingredients and the things that the dog has previously been on to select the best diet. And I think that that's not always done. Mm-hmm. Quite well.
Yeah. So let me throw a little wrench in here, because I'm assuming that is in a dog that only has suspect food allergy that we're talking about, otherwise healthy. Okay. So let's throw the scenario that the dog has a comorbidity.
Oh,
can't do it.
We have those so too.
Yeah. So, which one? Which one?
Yeah. So let's say kidney disease.
Ooh, okay.
Okay.
There are some multifunction diets that are available, which is really great. A lot of times, if you have a dog that really has major issues, a lot of times I'll call a nutritionist.
Yep.
And get their opinion, or an internist, and just see, you know, mm-hmm. how bad is the kidney disease? Do we have to focus on that? Or can I do this prescription diet that may not be kidney friendly?
Yeah.
But that can be really challenging.
Some of them really are. So diabetic cats, that's a really, really, really hard one. Diabetic dog too, but diabetic cat particularly. I literally, the other week, messaged my internal medicine friend and said, what food diet, you know, diet trial, hydrolyze, whatever can I use for this diabetic cat that is very well controlled with their diabetic diet? And he said, Sophie's Choice. So AKA, there's really nothing great for that. Mm-hmm. So there are some comorbidities that are tough. If you have animals that have a lot of GI, personally, I reach for the hydrolyzed diets and the GIs. I think that tends to work quite nicely for your diarrhea or soft stool dogs. And then if you have a dog that has a lot of pancreatitis issues, Hills now has their ZD low fat, which the low fat is not low calorie. It's not for the chub chubs, but it's designed, I think, for miniature schnauzers, right, whose pancreas just wants to leave their body at all times. So that's a diet that might work really nicely if you have like a comorbidity with pancreatitis. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. And then a lot of us, of course, are seeing rescue dogs where we have zero diet history. So what is your go-to in those dogs where we really have no idea what proteins they've been exposed to?
In those instances, you really could choose any diet, honestly. Yeah. I mean, as long as it's a novel protein or typically novel. So a lot of times we do alligator, rabbits, or a hydrolyzed diet. I mean, those would be fine. What I don't do is over-the-counter diets just because of the contamination issue. And I always say to people, it's kind of like, I try to keep it cutesy because then people are like, oh, I totally get it. You know, it's kind of like a bag of M&Ms that says may contain peanuts, or this was processed in a facility that has XYZ. And some people that have themselves have food hypersensitivity or children that are highly allergic, they read those little notes on the back of packaging. Mm-hmm. So I try to explain it to people that way so they can understand the value of the prescribed diet and why we want them to do that. And that it's not forever. It's a diagnostic test. And that helps me get a little bit more adoption to the diet trial. Mm-hmm.
And what are you saying for duration? I know we've talked about if we use something to control pruritus, we can go a little shorter, but what is the expectation that you give at the beginning of this trial so parents can kind of say, if I can make it this many weeks, I'm pretty good. Like, what is that expectation?
I typically do 6 to 8 week diet trials, and we're looking for a very appreciable, like obvious change in the itch. So we want at least a 15% reduction in the pruritus. And there's been evidence to show most of these dogs within the first 6 to 8 weeks are going to have up to 90% of reduction in their clinical signs. So to me, it's important also to get that PVAS or that pruritus level at the beginning so we can assess where we start and where we end at the end of that 8 weeks. And then if there's been no change or just a teeny change, then to me that diet has not made a big difference. And so then we'll just re-challenge with the old food and likely will not have any flare because there was no improvement to start with. So that's what I do. And I think we do similar lengths of diet trials.
We do, for sure. And I think you brought up a great point. Tell the client what the expectation is so that they can get ready for that. Because, you know, just sending them home with a bag of food and all these rules and no end point is daunting. It's a lot to think about. But I usually say, give me 6 weeks. If you can give me 6 weeks with this, I'm going to try to get your dog off of Apoquel right around week 4 or 5. And then we'll see where we are. And if I pull your dog off of Apoquel at week 4 or 5 and there's zero better, they're still a 10 out of 10 pruritic, there's no change, I'm usually done with that diet trial by week 5. I don't continue it personally. If we pull them off of the Apoquel, you know, week 4 or 5 and they're improved, they are better, but maybe they're not 100% better, then I pop them back on the Apoquel and I continue that diet. But by week 8, you are going to get dramatic improvement in greater than 95% of your food allergic dogs. The old adage that you have to do it for 3 months is gone. By the way, I looked at that paper. We like to quote that 3 month thing. I looked at that paper. It's from like 1948. No, I think it's from 1980 something. Yeah. I literally had to get it out of the archives. It doesn't even recommend 3 months, guys. Anyway, so you don't need 3 months. And I think giving them a manageable time really helps get you the buy-in that you need for them to do it financially as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Joy, you mentioned the PVAS, which I don't think in general practice that we actually document as a PBAS. Yeah. We might say like a 10 out of 10 or a 1 out of 10.
That's a great point. Yeah.
But I think we've all had the families that come in and you go, how itchy is your dog? Mm-hmm. Like one is your dog goes like this once a day and 10 is their itching, scratching, biting, chewing, licking all day long, right? Yeah. And you might have one partner that's like a 3 and the other partner's like, it's an 82, and, you know, and then you're like fighting. How do you demonstrate like the levels of pruritus so that we can all be aligned, especially if we're referring cases to you? Mm-hmm. How do you explain that to a client?
So we do, so there is a PVAS, which is a little bit different than what we probably do in clinical practice on an everyday basis. Usually we do just a pruritus score, which is a little different, but 1 to 10 with 10 being severe pruritus. But I also say licking, chewing, biting, scratching, because sometimes people have different opinions of what itching means. So say, well, he doesn't itch, but he licks his paws constantly. You know, so we get that a lot. So to me, is 10 is all the time. 2 to maybe even 3 is almost a normal dog. So then that kind of puts it into perspective for them. But it is, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. So if they think it's a 10 out of 10, totally fine with that. And then we're going to see where we are in 8 weeks.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You see how the dial moves. Yes. If it started at a 10 when I would have called it a 5, hey, if we both end up at a 1, great.
That's great.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
So what happens in that moment of guilt when the client comes in and you're like, and they're like, my dog's still itching. And you're like, how'd the giant trial go? And they're like, and then they, you know, like it's like a confessional, right? Yeah. And it all comes out and there's tears and they feel bad. We don't want guilt associated with the human animal bond or with our relationship, right? With our clients. So what does that conversation look like when the client admittedly says like, I just couldn't do it?
So I always say, thank you for trying. I get it. I appreciate it. It's super hard to do. We gave it our best. Now let's move on. That's okay. It's okay if we can't do the diet trial at this time. I got good drugs, okay? We can still help your dog. We can work our hardest to get your dog itch-free. But, you know, thank you for trying. I appreciate it. And we'll move on now. And if stuff doesn't work, we may come back. We may come back to this. But for now, let's just keep trying to get your pet feeling better.
And what would you say is the success of control in the dogs that can't go through a diet trial, but we suspect there's a food allergy component and you're using other methods of control? Do you give them the expectation we might not see as much success? Or do you say, look, it's such a small percentage. We probably have atopy here and we're probably going to get, like, what does that conversation look like?
Yeah, I think I have that conversation a lot. I talk about statistics, especially in a non-seasonally pruritic dog that's worse in the summer. Like, I'll down-regulate my concern for food hypersensitivity. And I talk about those statistics. And I say, well, listen, it's less likely to be food. We're just going to table this for now. Because, of course, the guilt. I mean, there's no reason for that. It's fine. I mean, there's a lot of things that I feel at as well. And I would not be able to do a diet trial in my house. So
she wouldn't.
I would not.
Nope.
So
I've met her children.
Yeah, and my dog that eats litter. So it, you know, it would not happen. So I totally understand. I don't put any judgment on it. We just put a note, and if we have to go back to it, we will. But the antipruritic drugs, they can work in a food hypersensitivity dog. So we'll try it. And if we're stuck and we find that nothing's working and everything, he's refractory to everything, then we can always go back to that diet.
So how do you encourage clients to medicate their pets during a diet trial when we know we can't use, you know, squeezed cheese and peanut butter and Slim Jims? But I understand why they're using them. I mean, they're yummy. But what is the alternative during that time?
So this is hard, and this is a great way to watch dermatologists fist fight, maybe. So there is some opinion to this, full disclosure. So I am of the belief that, like, a vegetable's okay. Like, I don't think I see many sweet potato allergic dogs or carrot allergic dogs. So if I have dogs that need pills and they need a way to get into them, I'm okay with peanut butter. I know that's wild, but I'm actually okay with peanut butter. I also tell people to use vegan cheese because they have much higher regulations FDA wise. When it's called vegan, it cannot have animal proteins. They're much stricter about that in the human world. I use vegan marshmallows, not regular marshmallows. They got the horse hoof in them, you know what I mean? But vegan marshmallows, and you can find those at just about any grocery store. Those work well. There is actually a company called Serenergy, and they make what's called a pill wrap-it, and they're a lovely company. We've talked to them a lot, so that's like one of the only over-the-counter things that I'm okay with. Wrap-it is like a powder, and if you add a little water to it, you can make a paste out of it, and then you can wrap that around the pill and give that like a pill pocket. I use a lot of sweet potato. I have them bake a lot of sweet potato and roll it and things like that,
And I'm similar to that. And I also, if I know up front that that patient needs something for pilling, then I'll choose a diet that has a good canned option.
Yeah.
And we just stick it in a meatball.
Yeah. Awesome. Any last minute debunks, demystifying moments, any tips, tricks that you want to leave with us regarding diet trial success?
Get them. So I think one big thing is get them back in for rechecks, in person, in phone, because one of my biggest pet peeves with diets are the dogs that have been on this food for a year and no one's ever checked in to say, are they better? You're still on Apoquel and Cytopoint every single month and this food. What did you ever challenge? Do we know that your dog even needs this food? Because that is a lot of money sent out. So when you first send out a prescription diet, I actually don't recommend you put on PRN refills. I recommend you put on enough refills for 3 months and that's it. Because then when that person calls because they ran out of their food, your front desk staff will call you and say, Myrtle needs her refill. And you'll look back and be like, oh my God, I haven't talked to Myrtle in 3 months. Is that, you know, HF even working? And then you can at least call Myrtle's people or have them in for a recheck so that you can have a communication. And if they say, I've been feeding it for 3 months and I'm still giving the Apoquel and I've never stopped it, that's a point of intervention. If you do PRN refills, it's gone. Your front desk will continue to refill that food or Chewy will or whoever will. And you're not going to see that patient again, potentially, because the client doesn't understand. So try to help the client out by actually not giving them a lot of refills at the very beginning of the diet trial. Now, once it's food allergic, PRN till the cows come home, I'm fine with that, but that can really help. The other thing that I think in your practice can help is have them come in for an in-person, set it up at when you start the diet trial, have them make an in-person appointment with you so that you can chat about what's going on and have them leave with that appointment in their hot little hands, if at all possible. They may cancel it, sure, but at least you've done your part then to encourage communication moving forward with those cases.
Yeah. Yep, totally agree. You have to use this as a diagnostic test and prescribe the amount of time, get them back in and do that re-challenge so we know for sure, are we food allergic or not? You know, and is this food valuable for that patient?
Yeah. And I would say for us as generalists, be efficient with your time. Mm. We don't need to do a diet trial on every itchy dog. It's so important to be taking those histories, those first time offenders, especially if we know their history, we don't need to be talking about this. And I think the other thing that we don't do as well as dermatologists, we can always improve our handouts. Mm-hmm. We can't just, you know, vomit all of this information to the caretaker who's in the room because usually it's not the person a lot of times that's actually doing the work at home. Yeah. So I think it's important for us to have multiple forms of information that we're sending home with our clients. We are out of time for this podcast, but we have a few more minutes if anybody has questions, I think, in regards to time. Otherwise, we will wrap up and let you enjoy Nashville tonight. Are there any questions from the audience?
You're going to rock your diet trials?
Yeah.
Heck yeah.
Awesome.
Well, thank you very much for your attention, for coming.
Thank you.
We'll see you tomorrow at FET.
Thank you.